Thank you so many of you showing up today. It's a great pleasure to be in the Twin Cities. I'd never been here before, and I would say go Gophers, go Gophers. I see 10 places in the audience, and I don't mind people sitting on the stairways, but there may be an influx of people, hundreds of them, that may want to join. So those of you on the stairs, could you please consider getting into a comfortable seat instead of torturing yourself for an hour and a quarter? Yeah. Today, I'm very happy, I'm very pleased to be here. And why? Because the audience of people is close to my heart. People that are interested in global health issues, medical people, people that are studying political science, it's all great to me. It's all, I'm very happy that you are here. I assume that you have a background in what's going on in Darfur, but I will tell you a story as well about what happened to the people there, because it is about the people for me. It's not about me. I did not do the care in 25,000 refugees. I had a team of 100 refugee staff, and I had 6 Chadian healthcare staff who did the work, and I was their supervisor. To me, I always emphasize that the work is done by refugees themselves and not only by expatriates that may look heroic, but actually the real heroes to me are the girl standing here, because she had no choice. But today I expect with an audience like yourself that there will be many, many questions. And I like dialogue more than monologue. And I will tell you a story of the people that I've worked and lived with, give you a little bit of the background of the conflict in Sudan in general, and then plunge into health care related issues because it seems that is our common interest. Am I mistaken here, or are there other things you would like to hear from me right now? No differences of opinion? Then I will move on to one of my friends in the refugee camp, a boy like maybe one of your children or younger brothers and sisters, who should have what we have, that is peace and prosperity and an opportunity to go to a primary, secondary school or even a university. For those of you, Africa, Sudan is the biggest country in Africa. And it has an extensive history. And the history comes from many different sides. In fact, Sudan as a country or as an entity has been ruled by different countries for many years. At first for thousands of years by the Egyptians. It's only for a short period of time that the Nubians, who came from Sudan, ruled over Egypt, a period of 100 years roughly. And where you see the black pharaoh, that is actually a Sudanese. But the other 1,000, 2,000 years, you could say that the rule was from Egypt to Sudan. When the Turks took over Egypt as a powerhouse, again, the rule, they were lorded over by Turkish people. And when the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, collapsed, it was the Brits that took over Sudan and the remains of Sudan. And within Sudan, there's a couple of things I would like to describe for you. And first of all is the geology of the country. Sudan literally means Sud, the swamp in the south, coming from the river Nile, where my house is located, or my future house, I should say, because it's not there, only in the mind. Lake Victoria is the beginning of the Nile, the white leg of the lake. And then there is, of course, Lake Tana, which comes from Ethiopia, where the water flows in to join. And in the past, there was a third arm to the Nile, the Yellow Nile. Most people don't know about this. The Zagara people definitely know. Those are the people that worked in the refugee camp with me and lived there. They were fishermen 1,500 years ago until they were forced to change their profession or their way of livelihood by becoming into pastoralists. Back to the history of Sudan. There are several routes of importance for the Sudan, and I'm trying to show you the lifestyle of people here. Sudan, with all its neighboring country, and it's a conflictious area today, and it's always been conflictious because many different tribes live together. But Sudan in general, some general information. There's about 30 million people, estimated, of which 20 million are Islamic and living in the north, of which they have different sorts of Islam, Sufism, they have Sunnis and they have Shiites, mainly Sunnis and Sufis. The south of the country is Christian. Now, originally everybody in Sudan is an animist, so they were converted. The trading route through Saudi Arabia into Ouagadougou, which is actually, where is my remote? Over here. In this beautiful country over here. Ouagadougou or Timbuktu. Camel trade took place from here to there and back. And on the road, the traders set up mosques, and they made sure that people were converted into Islam. And it was a successful mission. From the south of the country, 10 million people live here, and through Lake Victoria and up across the Nile, missionaries came in, Christian missionaries. There's a great variety of Christian churches in Uganda, but also in South Sudan. You'll see Catholics, Lutherans, Protestants, Jehovah's, Seventh-day Adventists, Baptists, and more than I can even memorize. But they're Christian with a heavy animistic slant. Now, we're talking about Darfur, but to understand the conflict of Darfur, I'll have to explain a little bit more about the conflicts within Sudan itself. When Sudan became independent, it were the people in the north that took over the power over this girl and the power of this country. The people of the north were living in Khartoum, and they took the full power. And they imposed their Sharia law, Islamic law, over the whole country. And that meant that those 10 million, or at that time probably 6 million Christians, had to abide by the rules of Islam. That means no alcohol. That means when you want to go to university, you have to declare yourself a Muslim. That means that you cannot practice your Christian belief. And that was an affront to the people in the south, and straight away they went into rebellion. First in the Anyanya movement, which was called after a snake. They attacked the Sudanese government, and that moved into what's called the Sudanese People Liberation Movement or Army. They fought for 22 years. And none of the parties could beat the other party. The north was not strong enough to hold more than the major cities, the ones that are not on this map, because it is a biased map. But neither could the south beat the north. After 22 years, 8 years of peace, and then another 17 years of clash. And remarkably, in 2003, they came to a peace agreement, the so-called Comprehensive Peace Agreement. It's there that the people in power in the north of Sudan could turn their arrows to Darfur. Or in fact, the people in Darfur, the Zagawa, the Fur, the Masalit, were tired and fed up of being ignored. And they would launch into what is called a rebel movement or a freedom movement. Now, before we go into that specific rebel movement, I have to tell you a little bit more about Darfur itself. Darfur, a mixture of camel herdsmen, a mixture of sedentary agriculturalists, 6 million people living in an area the size of Texas. And you would say, well, that'd be big enough, right? But the problem in Darfur is a lack of water. And the problem in Darfur is that there's a climate change taking place in the world, and specifically in Darfur. I remember being in the refugee camp. I could literally see the sand blowing over the exposed sides of the camp. There were houses being abandoned because they could not keep up with the amount of sand being blown into their houses every day and coming over the walls. So they moved to the other side of the camp. That's on a daily or on a monthly and a yearly basis. Just imagine how the desert Sahara has increased in size. Now, 6 million people with cows and camels and trying to grow crops leads to clashes. The Zagawa people, as you see, camel nomads or cow nomads trek with their tribes, trek from the north to the center of Darfur or to the south of Darfur or even into northern Baragazal, which is South Sudan. And on the way, it was not always peace. In fact, there were clashes between different tribes. 60 tribes at least in Darfur. Some are Arabic by nature, some are Fur, some are Masalit, some are Zagawa, and they do not always get along. Different lifestyle, different language, same resource, water. Same resource, grassland. So when a fight broke out, is it too much of noise, the microphone, or there's a question? Okay. When a fight broke out in the past between the people trekking in with their cows and the agriculturalists, they had a system in place to reduce the violence. They would have something called the dia, or blood money. And for a price of 100 camels, if I would kill one of you from Minneapolis, your tribe of the people of Minneapolis could kill one of my tribe unless I would give you 100 camels for a male And I'm sorry, ladies, only 50 camels for a woman. If I would not pay up, you could kill me or one of the women of my tribe. And this more or less reduced the depth of the conflicts and the battles going on. Another factor why the wars were less violent is the fact that there were less people, that there was more space, more water, but also that the guns they had were arrows and bows and spears until 50 years ago, when things slowly started to change, when weapons were flushed into the system by the powers that be in Khartoum. Now, one of my friends in the refugee camp, Adam Suleiman, who was a mathematician, told me the story how his father used to go to a tribe in northern Barghazal, and they would offer two cows to be slaughtered, and this tribe would offer the grains, and they'd have a feast for 3 days, and they would intermarry. And this was an Arabic tribe. So whatever people tell you about that this conflict is due to black versus Arabic or versus Sufi versus Sunni, it's not that simple. It's actually much more simple. It's called the game of divide and rule, which the rulers of Sudan know very well how to do. You see this circle over here? I was in South Sudan in Juba, roughly here. I can't find on the map. And Abyei, this is a controversial point, and this is the main reason there's a conflict going on in Sudan. There's oil in South Sudan. And all the money flows from the south to the north. In fact, the south only gets 5% of the profit of the oil, while all the money flows up, and Khartoum is one of the most beautiful cities in Africa. It's sad to see that there's such a disparity of wealth, a distribution of wealth. Now, I'm not saying that all the people in the north of Sudan are bad people. In fact, I have a friend who is a Jale, the same tribe as Omar al-Bashir. He's a social worker, and he decided to work in the desert with me to serve people that are vulnerable. I think that's amazing. I'd never judge an entire tribe. I will just say that Omar al-Bashir and his close friends are not so nice. In 2008, in May, there was a peace conference going on in Juba where the South declared they wanted to become a political movement instead of an army movement. The SPLA would convert into the SPLM, and they'd become a whole country political movement after fighting for 39 years. They said they would beat the leading party, Omar al-Bashir's party. They're having a peaceful conference. They included delegates from all over the country, and Abyei, which is one of the main oil raising areas, was attacked. And it's never attacked by the Sudanese armed forces, but also always by proxy war. And that's one of the sad things that you will see in African conflicts. It's never armies fighting armies. It's always militias being armed by people. And it's never army against army. It is always militia against a village. Militia against women. Militia against children. What's happening in East Congo today, where the Lord Resistance Army is raising havoc, they're not fighting the armies. They're attacking villages. 900 people got killed. Probably several hundred children got kidnapped. Lips are being cut off again. That's what I saw when I worked in North Sudan, North Uganda. I saw that happening, and there's nothing more traumatizing. You have a question?
Yeah, is Khartoum still funding the LRA?
Well, I wouldn't say that black on white, but I know that they do have their tools to. When I go back one slide or two slides, all these countries, I have to be honest here. All these countries have conflicts with one another, and each party is funding the other party's rebels. So when you see the Lord Resistance Army over here, it was used as a weapon against the South Sudanese SPLA, so it was funded by Khartoum, at least for many years. Currently, I would not know. Possibly, yes. When you talk about Congo and Rwanda, it's clear that Rwanda is taking items from Congo. When you talk about Ethiopia and Eritrea, there has been influence in Sudan in either the one or the other, and Eritreans sponsor rebels in Sudan. So I'm not going to point one way. I'm going to point all the ways, including to you people, but also to the people in power here. Yes, there's a nasty mess going on. That's geopolitics, unfortunately. Instead of building schools, creating clean water, we tend to focus on selling weapons and selling military influence and having children and women suffer. But back to the story of the South and the North and their struggles and their fights and what the impact was on Darfur, because I lost the thread of my reasoning right now, is that when the peace agreement between the North and the South, and they are in a government right now, and there is a census that has been done, and there'll be a national election, and that in Sudan is very special. You know, we can sit in the United States, and I've seen your election 8 years ago. It was a mockery, right? What happened there? I don't care who won or lost. I thought it was a mockery. But at least there were rules in place. In Sudan, it's much harder to see that reality. There'll be an election coming up in a year, and then the South may decide if they want to stay together with the North or not. Either way, there is a clear destination for war between North and South because the resources... Sudan, as an agricultural country, has become a country where oil is the main way of income. So it's going to be very hard for me to envision peace. And my Sudani friends from South, North, East, and West all tell me the same thing. There are many good-hearted and good-natured people, but there's a minority of idiots that want to have all the money, and that's the greed. Now, back to Darfur. 2003, Darfuris were fed up that their first school was built in 1950, that their first hospital was built in 1960, that their first roads were built in 1970, and they waged a rebellious movement against the Sudanese armed forces. Lo and behold, that they stood up for their own rights, but they did. And the funny thing is, they were nomadic people, they knew how to fight, and they beat the government's troops. 25 out of 30 battles, they won. They're in the winning hand. Sudanese Liberation Army, a unison army of Zagawa, Fur, Masali came together and beat the army. And so the army reverted into their old strategy of slash and burn, of using all kinds of troops to kill these lovely people and force them into refugee camps like this and areas like this that these kids don't want to be. They're only 100 kilometers or 60 miles away from their home, but they've been born in Chad and they never will go home to Sudan until it's peaceful. And I hope that today we can start a dialogue to get that achieved. That boy's like this is another story that is of utmost shame. He's a Goran. His parents fled Chad when the Libyans invaded Chad. He went to Sudan. He went to Darfur. Guess what happened 4 years ago? He had to flee back from Sudan into Chad. And when he came into Chad and lived into a refugee camp, he was not a refugee. This boy was born in Sudan, but he is technically a Chadian because his father was a Chadian. Therefore, he's not allowed to live in a refugee camp, because he's an IDP, an internally displaced person. That's when George Orwell wrote 1984, I don't have to read the book anymore. I see it on a daily basis with the United Nations. And having said that, it's the most powerful structure that we have for a world government with respect to all the nations. It's the most powerful tool we have. And see what we do with it, what the United States does when it's funding it or not. When the European Union's European Union is not helping out, when the Arab League thinks about their own investments, when the African nations think about themselves, they don't think about the people in Darfur. The people like these kids, or the story that Zara told me. Zara is my midwife, and we'll slowly ease into the refugee camp and talk a lot about that. And I'll show you some photos on the side, because I think health is one of the prime outcome indicators of how much we care. This is what happened to Zara. Zara one day woke up and had seen that her neighboring village was on fire. And so she prepared her kids, and so she prepared her sister and her two donkeys and some food and some water to run away. And they came to the village. They started bombarding it with this helicopter and setting it on fire and destroying it completely. Well, it didn't stop there. Obviously, the village was surrounded by Janjaweed, as they're called, devil on horseback, which I have some comments on later. Together with the Sudanese armed forces, they surrounded the village, they rounded up the cattle, stole it. Then they went into the houses and took away all the belongings of the people. Then they burned the remainders of the houses, and then they put the men of young age on a line and shot them in front of other people to see that they're what's called an abit. Now, if you want to be a bad person or an insensitive, stupid person, call a Sudanese an abit. It's the old world word used to describe slave, black-skinned slave. I didn't tell you yet, but there was slave trade in Sudan hundreds of years ago. And to the day of today, I have a friend whose sister is captured as a slave in Khartoum. And I wish I could say different things. It's one of the universal rights of human beings not to be enslaved. Well, it's still happening today, and we're doing nothing about it. Village was burned. Men were shot. Women were raped in front of an audience. And then they were told, go, Abid, go. And when they left, with their nothing belongings, their two donkeys, they ran off. It's like a computer game almost. They were followed with helicopters and jeeps, and like pot shots were taken at them. Zara told me it took her 4 days, actually 4 nights, to run a distance of 100 kilometers, 60 miles, to go across to Bahai, where her fellow people were. They fled there because there was a lake, and the lake would give enough water. And they fled there because the people of Bahai are Zagawa people, and they're known to the people in Kornoi, Mboro, and Faraway, the three villages that are destroyed like this. And when they arrived, the story didn't end, of course. They started to live after this in a structure like what you see behind this girl. This is our friend Omar al-Bashir, the one that's responsible. He came to power 19 years ago into a military coup, and he's not a nice man, I think. And this is the guy who organized that genocide and is now the Secretary for Humanitarian Affairs in Darfur, talking about cynicism. And so another story about the international arena. Do you know the G77? Yeah, that's the group of poorer countries or developing countries, including China. Do you know who they selected as a chair for their United Nations seat? Sudan. And that's pretty sad. That means that Susan Rice and Secretary Hillary Clinton have to do dealings with Sudan. Because you can't ignore one of the most powerful blocs in the United Nations. These are the Janjaweed. Now, many bad things have been said about them, and I do not want to say any Arab or any black or any white or any Christian or any person is bad by nature. They were often not given a choice. Many of these men had their women and children taken hostage, and it was clear that if they would not act, kill their neighbors, they would be killed. That's a hard choice to make, and I can understand that a young man like this then goes to war and kills the neighbors instead of having his daughter killed. Yeah. But it's about this, the kids and the refugee camp, not about death. And this is how they live. Now, given the nature of the people here in the room, I'm just going to ease into some stories about the refugee camp, and that to me show the remarkable resilience and dignity and humor that these people have. And I think from here on, if any point you want to ask a question, feel really easy to ask me a question, because there's 100 topics I can talk about the camp. But let me talk to you about a story which shows the strength of the women in a refugee camp. Now, do all of you know what female genital mutilation is? Does everybody know? Okay, roughly there's three styles, and I don't have to go into it graphically, and I don't have pictures. But the one is called an Egyptian style, where as a woman you are mutilated completely, you lose everything that is around a vagina, and you're sutured up in such a way that the opening sometimes is yay big. So this big. So you can just pass urine, and you're having sexual relationships with your husband. It must be horrible. And you get urinary tract infections. When Angelina Jolie came to the refugee camp, and by the way, she is really beautiful and has a kind heart, first of all, she asked me, she wanted to talk to women and children. She did not want to talk to men. I said, okay, I know this great woman called Zara. Zara is my buddy. I always end up drinking tea with her, and she, you know, whenever I'm upset, she would talk with me and, you know, give me direction. So she said, I want to talk about female genital mutilation. Is that a problem? I said, well, I know Zara. I'll ask her. And so Zara said, yeah, sure. I'll tell her about my Egyptian style of FGM. She doesn't speak English that well, but just the basics, and my Arabic is not that good, but we can just communicate. And I had a translator. The poor man, he had to translate everything. But respect for him. He did translate everything. He was a Chadian gentleman. And I really, to the day of today, wonder what he must have been thinking. But Zara told her story that when she was a child, she was born. Now, first of all, female genital mutilation takes place in many countries in Africa, Christian, Muslim, animist. It's nothing to do with religion. It's a power control thing over women. That's my view on it. I don't see why it's done, but for men to be in charge of women, causing them a lot of pain, miscarriage, death, children death. So there's no benefit to me, as I can think of mutilating a woman like that. But it's what happened. Zara told me that she has had a full circumcision, which is not the right word. It's a mutilation. Then she said, okay, well, I was still in the village and I'm the midwife, so it's the women that do it. I could manage that my children, the oldest one, had a half style, and that still means losing your clitoris and still means sutured up, but at least being able to pass urine in a normal way. And it's not as extreme, although it's already too extreme. That's what she could do for her children. Now, what happened in the refugee camp? 90% of the people living in the camp are women and children. And she said with a smile on her face, and that she usually used to smile, she has the most beautiful smile of everybody I've ever met. She pulled me close and Angelina and say, you know, men have no clue about female anatomy. And I said, what do you mean, Zara? So what do we do right now? We take a razor blade and make a deep cut in the labia. Sorry, girls. Deep cut, about an inch. Very deep. A lot of blood. And we catch all the blood on a white towel. And we let it bleed. We let her bleed. We let her bleed. We let her bleed. And we suture her up. 2 stitches. Nothing is gone. And they show it to the men. And they say, look here, we did a circumcision. Well, the men have no clue, so they go, oh, they have their party. Because a woman has been signed or marked. Then when she gets married, this girl has no lesion in her vagina. She has no suturing, so she can give normal childbirth. And Sarah was just smiling at me. See, these men, they don't have a clue that they've been tricked. No, I don't think they're tricked. I think the women have shown their resilience and their dignity and a sense of humor as well. By in a period of 5 years, abolishing a practice that's been around for hundreds of years. You see, not everything that comes out of a genocide is necessarily bad. It also means that people step up to their potential. When the men are not there, women have to take leadership roles. When the men are not there to protect them, it's the women that sort out the food, sort out the finance, sort out the job, sort out the water, make decisions. And this is a patriarchal society by far. These are Zagawa, these are proud men, but they're all killed. So it's the women that take on the leadership roles. I find that so beautiful. She never told me that, but at least I can share that story with you. So the practice of female genital mutilation, I hope for their tribe, their subclan, is a history. Now, another way that Zara had a huge impact on me is talking about what were priorities for her. After having gone through that violence against her and that we should act up about it, she said that, well, the good thing about it is that in the old days, women got married when they're 13, 14, 15. But now in the refugee camp, at least there's a primary school and there's nothing to do. So we send everybody to the primary school. And again, it is under a tree like this, with a finger in the sand, they would draw and teach people. The teachers would, without books, pens, anything. In the burning, scorching sun, they would teach their children. And when the United Nations, and we're talking about the greater body, UNICEF, bless you. When UNICEF would say, we need an intervention that is camp-wide. There are 300,000 refugees in Chad living in 12 refugee camps. We want them all at the same time to have universal education, i.e. secondary education, high schools. The Zagawa said, you know what? Why don't you take your UNICEF tents and get out of here? We're starting up our own secondary school. We don't need you. Just go. That's embarrassment for UNICEF. Before they wanted to open up schools, the camp Urukasoni started up secondary schooling. And even if it's only for 50 students, it's better than for 0 students. Now we come to the other end. Yes, sir, go ahead. Question?
Oh, yeah. I just wondered about the UNICEF thing. Why did they tell them to go? I think I missed something.
They told them to go because the question is, why did the refugees ask UNICEF to leave? Well, UNICEF rules, regulations, 119 countries pulling cords, cornered, earmarked money. You cannot spend before or after a certain date. High-paid consultants. I'm not going to lambast them because they do great work, but I think they're highly overpaid. That's all. They must follow their own protocols. It cannot be that a refugee, bear in mind, a refugee takes control of his life. Why do you think the symbol of UNHCR is like this? Is it to shelter refugees or is it to push them down? Why is it not like this to lift them up? Their symbol represents for me UNHCR. The symbol of United Nations, High Commission for the Refugees, is two hands sheltering refugees. Well, to me, it looks a lot like pushing them down. That's the attitude that they have for me. Not like this, pushing them up. It would be a much more positive sign. But anyway, who am I to blow against the wind? And again, it's United Nations that does a great job despite all of my frustrations with them. That people are living like this. Because the United Nations is a reflection of all of us individuals, all of our countries. We fight, and we forget the human rights. The human rights of people. That says, I have the book, and I don't think I have it with me right now, but I know it by head right by now. There's something like Article 3 in the Declaration for Human Rights, which says that we all have a right for life, security, and peace. Well, I don't think that these people have a right for security, life, and peace, and we're letting it go on. I think we all have a right to healthcare access. Now, why does this gentleman have polio? Because there were no vaccinations in a conflicted area. I have seen cases of polio in Chad. It makes me mad that a disease that was almost eradicated is back because we accept conflicts going on because we want to exploit areas like in Congo. Does anybody know why we have a conflict in Northeast Congo? Anybody have an idea?
Coltan.
Yeah, sounds good to me. $250 million flowing into the coffers of Rwandan military. What it means is that you all want to have a mobile phone, the Blueberry, the Blackberry. Well, to have that communicable machine, you need a metal that is coltan, which you probably only find in Northeast Congo. And the reason that over the last 15 years, 5 million people, excess mortality, on top of normal death, documented in The Lancet and New York England Times by the International Rescue Committee. 5 million people on top of the normal deaths in Congo. Millions of people raped in Congo. All in Northeast, well, more all over the country. But Northeast, why? Because they have coltan there. It's so sad. It's so sad how we want comfort zones in our lives and don't want to see the downturn of the comfort zone. Anyway, these people still believe in building society. They're the first to step up to help their own. And you know what the sad part is? Even though when these women go out for firewood, they don't really have a choice, right? What do? This is the choice. You get wood and petrol for a week per month. That's what United Nations can afford because United Nations is not funded enough by the US, the European Union, and so on and so on. We're not paying our dues. So the women get only 1 week of firewood and petrol per week, per month. So what do? You go out and walk three. This is, by the way, a camp more in the south. Otherwise, the wood would be only a quarter of the size of this wood and only 3 days walk. So the women have a choice. They either give their children raw beans and raw lentils, which is not really survivable, or they go out and have a risk and take a shot at being abused, shouted at, beaten up, or in the worst case, raped or killed. And I think all of them do the same. They go out there to make sure that their kids have warm meals. And so when they are unlucky enough to get raped, they also get marked for life. Now, this is a structure and a country where a raped woman is not viewed as a woman anymore. So her life, married life is over as far as her husband is still alive, and she can never remarry again because of the mark of this jackass that did this, and that should be persecuted by international criminal court or by local mechanisms. Yet the children are there, and they want education. Yeah, sure.
So you're saying that the rapists
marked them? The question is, do the rapists mark them? Yes, it's the people that mark that give a sign, usually in the inside of the thigh or preferably in somewhere you can see it, in the face. They sometimes brandish letters or initials or Arabic signs or a mark on the arm. So you can always see that they were abused. And of course, the offspring, you know, they don't believe in abortion. And there's many different belief systems that do not allow abortion, as far as it's not even possible in many, many cultures. I saw many kids that were my skin color in the camp, and I'm sure that their father was slightly light-skinned Arabic. And they're just as much, loved just as much as their other children are. And, you know, this is the sad part of the story. When you look at a primary school or a primary school or a kindergarten school, and you hope, their hope is education, their hope is a peaceful resolution of the conflict. And what do you do when you are 18 years old, and you're a guy, and you are brimming full with testosterone, and you've got your education, and it stops there? What do you do? You can say, I hang around the camp. I don't get a job. I just be bored, senseless. There's no books, no cinema, no Wii, no theater, no footballs, no nothing. So if you are a peaceful guy, you probably go out there with the 5 goats you have and try to make them 10 or 15 in the years. Breed your goats. But if you're young, 18, brimful of testosterone, and you get somebody that comes up to you, you know what? Why don't you revenge your mother? Why don't you revenge your brother? And gives you an AK-47? Those camps right now are breeding grounds for rebels. And I can't blame them. You know, we're sitting here. They're there in the camp for 6 years. Has anything changed in their situation? What I said in the CBS 60 Minute document came down to this, that we accept the situation as it is. I said in October 2006, and if there's anything I want to make myself and a fool on national television, watched by 70 million people, is about being wrong on the outcome of a genocide. It's about saying that the situation will be the same in 2008, October. I said, 2 years down the line, we're going to say, ich habe es nicht gewusst. That's what the Germans said after the Second World War when they were confronted with the deeds, their horrific deeds of the people that were in power in Germany then. They said, ich habe es nicht gewusst. It means, I didn't know. Well, nobody doesn't know what's happening in Darfur, yet we know it and let it happen. Well, I just hope that these kids, and they'll be in the camp another 10 years. The way things are moving right now, they'll be in the camp another 10 years. The average time people spend in a refugee camp is 15 years. Isn't that sickening? That we accept that. How would you feel if St. Paul would be invaded by the Canucks? Manitobians coming in with guns, and all the blonde girls are circled out, and their hair is cut, and they're raped. And the guys with blue eyes are all circled out and shot. And all the houses and all the Wees and all the cars are stolen. And you're told to go to Detroit. Well, I don't think you want to go to Detroit in the first place. But just the comparison, that's the skill we're talking about. You guys have 2 to 3 million people living in the Minneapolis metropolis, right? There's 3 million people not living where they're from. There's 6 million people in Darfur. There's 5 million people in Minnesota. Imagine half your state is living in Detroit. Imagine that half of Minneapolis is killed. 350,000, 400,000. Imagine you don't want that to happen. So why, in heaven's name, why do we accept this? That this kid does not get an opportunity like you do.
That's actually happened in America with the American Indians and the Mormons.
Thank you, sir. It has happened in the United States with the Native Americans and the First Nations
and the Mormons.
Exactly. And, well, I have to say I have many Native American friends, and I do use it as an example. So thank you for referring me to that. Actually, in India, we have Native people. And there seems to me that people that live a hunter-gathering lifestyle are not respected by agriculture and societies and onwards. What does it mean? In Japan, they wiped out the original inhabitants of Japan. In India, we're wiping out all the tribes that are living in the forest or in the mountains. In Australia, what happened to the aboriginals? Are they going to be aboriginals in 50 years, or they're all going to be dead? In New Zealand, in the United States, how many Native Americans do we have left? Is it 700,000? There were 7 million when the settlers came. What about Canada? What about South America with all their Indian tribes? What have we done with them? And it's not only the conscious slaughter and enslavement and exploiting, but also, and now we're talking about health, public health. You come as an invader, you take your influenza, your syphilis, and you give it to people, and you kill them off with measles. Yeah, it's sad, but you're right, sir. The Mormons were persecuted, and the Native Americans were persecuted. But I don't want to bash up the United States. I want to bash up humanity for not caring. It says that there's a universal right for human beings. Well, I don't see it happening anywhere in the world. I'd like to see the first country where people are not oppressed on the basis of their gender, on the basis of their sex, on the basis of their sexual preference, on the basis of their religion, on the basis of their skin color.
Well, this is basically because the Convention on Human Rights is non-binding. There were several signatories to it, but it's non-binding to any of them.
Well, the gentleman is saying that.
The
gentleman is saying that the Convention of the Rights of I'm now getting confused. The Convention on the Human Rights is non-binding. You see, even if it would be binding, what does it mean? Okay?
Make it legal.
Yeah, okay, even if it's legal, what does it mean? I know that there are conventions all worldwide that we have and that we just ignore. We just ignore anyway. For me, you're right, sir. I mean, maybe your background is legal, but I don't believe in legalistic papers. I actually believe in a more spiritual approach to things, that people get enlightened and much more involved by joining advocacy groups, involved by, you know, understanding what's going on, involved by calling up your senator, involved by getting united to talk about what's going on in the world. That issues like the refugee camp, and I hope I told you some positive stories as well. And I believe in their resilience. I see their humor. I see their dignity. The reason I'm standing here is because I was touched by them, and I was blessed by them. And to be in their company meant a lot to me. And they don't have an opportunity or platform. Unlike the Jewish people who, after the Holocaust, after the Shoah, were able to film and to record and to write when, after about 10 years, they started to write about what went on. That is forever in history and unoutwipeable. People that deny it, well, yeah, you can deny a lot of things in life, but you're also stupid then. The problem with Darfur is that most people can't read or write there, or read or write enough, or don't have the media to express their feelings, or they're not filmed enough. This witnessing, these individual stories need to get out there. Those health risks, those risks to the lives, those risks to everything should be going out there. Yeah, we should give people an opportunity there. But I'm sure there's questions. I think I've talked quite a while. I'm sure there's questions. So who has a question?
Could you talk a little bit about your role in the refugee camp? You talked a bit about how you feel about some of the NGOs that are there in the UN, and you talked a bit about your personal friendships there. Could you talk more about kind of your role and how it played in?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I had 100 staff members, refugees, medical staff members. Oh, sorry, excuse me. The question is, could you talk about your personal medical role in the refugee camp? So, yeah, first of all,
your personal medical and also sort of, I don't want to say political because I don't mean it in the traditional sense, but, I mean, there's a lot of talk about sustainability and locally initiated, blah, 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 blah. Actually, I was in a locally initiated project folks over in India, and it wasn't the most locally initiated.
I hear you. So the question is about sustainability and the politics behind healthcare interventions, and it's a very deep question. So I'll try to come up with an answer, and that is very simple. What I tend to do, and it's not always of liking to non-governmental organizations, is to emphasize education. I have looked at the people that provide healthcare in the camp. What we do. I was responsible for the vaccination program. So I had 10 people going out there to spread vaccinations. They never got a training in vaccinations. They just knew which vaccine need to go there. I found a brochure on the internet, 50-page document, about everything, the side effects, how to do safe transmission, how to do safe injections, how to take care of the needles afterwards. And I personally trained people to train those 10 people. Okay, that's my intervention on that level, on vaccinations. Then I had a community health worker. Now, I surely believe that one doctor cannot take care of 27,000 people. That would be cocky. That would be idiotic, probably, even to say that. So we had a team of 33 community health workers. Now, there's a system called Integrated Management of Childhood Illness. It's been introduced in over 30 countries in the world, which identifies danger symptoms and signs in children. And you can expand that to adults. There's also adults modules for that. So the 33 community health workers were taught what they could treat at their own level. Let's take an example. Common cold, use a wick with water to clean the nose. Having a fever over 39 when they have a thermometer or when it feels really hot, watch for one day, make sure the child is not lethargic. If a red sign comes up, however, immediately refer to a medical center to the care of a nurse. So there was a home-based care done by the community health workers with a follow-up system whereby we would track people. They were trained in IMCI. I personally taught community health workers. Then I had 6 nurses, which needed to be honed and upgraded in their knowledge of diagnostics and treatment because they tend to give antibiotics for everything. So I cannot monitor 6 nurses taking care of 400 people a day. So what I did is train them individually about separate diseases and try to come to an understanding about the sustainability. At the end of the day, the white doctors will leave the camp and they'll go back to Darfur and they'll have no doctor trained. So I try to stimulate as much knowledge transfer as possible. As far as the midwives was concerned, I was also responsible for the midwives. There were 650 deliveries in the camp. I tried to train them with another document provided by another non-government organization about enticing women to come to the healthcare center. When I came, 5% of the women delivered at the healthcare center. When I left, 95% did. And it's about health incentives. It's about active dialogue. It's about respecting women. It's about getting the local women involved. So we had 6 midwives. We hired 10 traditional birth attendants who were not good enough to do deliveries, however, had the respect of the community to interact. So now at least everybody knew about the facilities that we had for delivery. They knew they'd get food. They knew they'd get a blanket. They knew they'd get it's simple, a plastic, you know, washing thing. That's all it takes. And soap. Invest $5 and get all the women to come. Because also now you can identify them to come before a delivery. So antenatal checkups, again, done by the women themselves. So they identify those women that have a probably slow development of a pregnancy or are 1 meter and 30 centimeters or are too light for weight. So then on top of that, my responsibility also entailed writing up budgets for the camp, making the medical order for 27,000 people, going to the political meetings with United Nations and other NGOs countrywide. I was also the medical director of the hospital, which had 30 beds. Gracefully, I'm not a surgeon, so I did not have to do surgery. But when the soldiers came in with their bullet wounds, I was also doing surgery. Where does it stop? I don't know. I was supposed to do everything, I guess, because there were supposed to be 4 expatriates, but we only found one. That's a problem. And about sustainability in a camp, I've worked in the emergency side, and I've seen the negatives of that, and I've worked on the sustainability side, and I've seen the negatives of that, and let's just turn it around. Let's not make it a negative discussion, but let's take the best points of both systems and integrate it and use it. When I'm going back to Uganda, I'm starting up an organization. I've actually started it up already called Phoenix Global Unitarian Foundation. I identified 3 NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which I'm going to work with, who have a track record of 10 years, doing it of their own, with their own pockets, with their own money, with their own time, taking care of people living with HIV/AIDS, working on simple interventions like clean water. Does that slightly answer your question? I mean, this is a very deep question, which I could expand on for an hour more. Yes, sir. You can come. You can come in. That's a practical answer. I think time-wise, it's good. If you give me some, well, I think I'd like to ask questions. I know, but yeah, go ahead.
Some of the solutions.
This is one of the solutions, but I think I have to stand next to you because this is recorded.
Oh, right. My name is Alan Kennedy, and I am the interim director at the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. I also am the director in the state of Minnesota for the Genocide Intervention Network. And I would like to think that the person who just asked that question was a plant in the audience, because it's perfect. The question is, what's the answer to some of these kinds of conflicts? I heard a gentleman ask earlier about enforcement. What's happening with enforcement, with the Declaration of Human Rights, for example? We just passed the 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights and of the Genocide Convention, neither of which have any teeth globally. We know that. Absolutely true. The Genocide Prevention Task Force, headed by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and former Secretary of Defense William Cohen, issued a report in December on the 60th anniversary of those two conventions that we all wish were being enforced. And this Genocide Prevention Task Force report essentially says we must have a hand in recognizing when pre-genocidal situations are occurring around the planet, and we must, as a nation and as a part of a global community, intervene to keep these situations from escalating to the point of the crisis in Darfur, for example. This task force has made many recommendations about institutionalizing a structure within our government to raise funds to ensure that these situations are prevented. So that's one very positive point. Another is that the International Criminal Court has issued an indictment for genocide against Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. This is a pretty serious circumstance to have come about. There are 106 signatory nations to the International Criminal Court. The United States is not one of them. For us to try to advocate for the prosecution of Omar al-Bashir is extremely difficult, given that we are not a signatory. So there's an opportunity for our government to get on board. Former President Clinton had signed on with that in the last day of his administration. Former President George Bush reneged on that, and we'll see what the current administration chooses to do. There are things that every ordinary American, every ordinary person anywhere can do, and certainly in a democracy, the single most important thing is to urge our legislators to take action. Some of you have probably heard me say this before, but we need to call our delegates in Washington, D.C., and we need to say, you must take a stand against genocide. You must act to protect innocent women and children who are at great risk. We know that people don't make that call, and they don't make that call for three reasons. Often they don't know who their elected officials are. If they do know who they are, they have no idea how to reach them. If they figure out how to reach them, they have no idea what to say. So many of you are healthcare professionals. What do you do if you see an accident by the side of the road? What do? You call 911, right?
No, actually, I stop and provide help, Ellen.
Oh, you stop and provide help. That's true.
I was trained to do that.
Okay, let me see if I get reception here.
But 1-800-GENOCIDE is what we're calling
right
now.
There is a toll-free anti-genocide hotline, and the reception in this room is notoriously terrible.
We're going to get it?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to come through. What this number does is truly remarkable. You need one piece of information, and that is your zip code. You put in your zip code, and you then are automatically routed to your own representative in the House of Representatives. If you choose one, option one. If you choose option two, you go to your senator. We know in Minnesota today we only have one senator. So you go directly to Senator Klobuchar. If you press three, you go directly to the White House. I urge people to contact their elected officials. So once again, what is that number? 1-800-GENOCIDE. I happen to be a Jew, and I know that if people had made these calls, had urged our government back in the late 1930s, during the 1940s, to take action, certainly Hitler's acts of impunity would not have carried on to the extent that they did. But not enough people raised their voices. Not enough people took a stand. So I implore you to become active, to become engaged. There are other things I want you to do as well. How many of you are in the medical profession? All right, I want to tell you what your colleagues in the legal profession have done. And let's get a little bit of rivalry going on here. There is a divestment movement that is going on across the world. It's somewhat different than the divestment movement in South Africa, which urged every multinational to withdraw operations. that was effective in crippling the South African apartheid government in 1994, but it also created outrageous havoc with the lives of ordinary citizens. This is a divestment strategy designed to affect only about 24 companies that are complicit with buying the bombs, planes, guns, and bullets that are funding this genocide. 27 states have divested their public pension funds so far from this list of companies. Minnesota became state number 13 in the year 2007. There are 23 cities that have done this. There are more cities in the state of Minnesota than in any other state in the U.S. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Edina, and Hopkins. So if you live in Minnesota and you're not from one of those four cities, get on board with this initiative. Talk to your mayor, talk to your city council. The Minnesota State Bar Association, an organization of 15,000 attorneys, became the first professional association in the nation to pass divestment. So the gauntlet is thrown, my friends. Let's see if the medical association can do the same thing. If you're interested in assisting with this effort, please do see me afterwards. Now, March 3rd, we are going to be showing the premiere of a documentary called Genocide Again, Darfur, here at the campus of the University of Minnesota. Anna Donnelly, where are you? Raise your hand. Anna Donnelly, standing in the back, is one of the people featured in that documentary. Anna is a student activist. And Anna has done remarkable things, including being the former president of a student organization here on campus called STAND, a Student Anti-Genocide Coalition. How many of you are students? All right, Anna, Jessica, pass the form around. Sign up to become a member of STAND to learn about what it is each and every one of us can do. For those of you who are not students, who are here from the broader community, this same film will have a screening at Rabbi Glazer's Synagogue Temple Israel. Raise your hand, Rabbi Glazer. On Monday, March 16th, free and open to the public. Temple Israel is right near the Uptown neighborhood, 2324 Emerson Avenue South, 7 p.m. that evening. Therese, raise your hand. The American Refugee Committee is represented here. ARC has been running refugee camps in Darfur since 2004. I'm going to give Anna some flyers to distribute to you about ARC's work. The program director for Darfur is featured in this documentary as well. We have events listings that Jessica in the back has for you if you're interested in other events about the crisis in Darfur or Cambodia or other areas in the world where we are really trying to raise awareness. We know that a genocide doesn't stop on a particular day. Its repercussions endure for decades and decades. So I want all of you to do a couple of very important things. I want you to call 1-800-GENOCIDE. And I'm being very serious about that. And I particularly want you to make that call on Friday, February 13th. That day is being targeted to reach Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And you can get there automatically just by using that magic number. And I'm really sorry for the poor reception in this room. The particular request for Secretary of State Clinton is to appoint a special envoy to Darfur, someone who can tackle these issues, who can make sure that the perpetrators do not have ongoing impunity in the death and destruction and starvation and disease that's going on. So that's my message to you, and I'm very grateful that you all were here, and I thank you very much.
We actually have time for about one more, or maybe two more questions. Just two things. One is you were handed out an evaluation form. If you have a couple of minutes just to scribble, that's very helpful for us for current response and future planning. And secondly, one person made the point about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Declarations, it's correct, are not legally binding, whereas conventions are legally binding. So the International Covenant of Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, International Covenant of Civil Political Rights are legally binding, for which there's reporting and so forth, but declarations are for providing a moral horizon. And if you wanted to pick up a little bit on the second half of the last question about sort of your thoughts politically largely and also spiritually, what's important in terms of thinking about these things, you can pick that up and field a couple of more questions.
Yeah,
and then
sure.
We'll stop right on the mark at a quarter after.
Yeah, feel free to leave if you have another lecture to attend to. That's fine with me. I appreciate you being here. But to go into the question of spirituality, and all I can see and all I can say and all I can attest to is that what I've seen in these refugees is resilience, humor, and dignity. That when they lost everything, they still have dreams to go for. As Zara says, my nieces are going to university and getting a degree. And if you know Zara, you know it's true. She'll make sure it happens. They did not ever give up, not skip an eyelash. When they were bombarded in their camp, they were still staying there. They said, you know what? You want us to leave further into Chad? We're not going anywhere. You bombed the hood out of us. We're staying here. And you want us to leave here when the water ran out or when the Chadian government told them that they should leave and they should go to a safer place? They said, we're staying near our lands. We're going nowhere. You want us to leave? We go back to Darfur. Now, if people have that remarkable resilience, who can I and what can I say more than we all should show signs of that resilience, of that dignity, and a belief that a conflict, even if it takes 10, 15, 20 years, will be resolved? I can be nothing but a positive and an optimistic person in the light of what they've gone through and the attitude that they have. That's what I want to project to you. Yeah.
Anywhere else in the country. And I see a lot of interest and a lot of desire for both physicians and students to work abroad, go abroad. But I hear, that you couldn't find three other expat physicians to work with you or local physicians. Why is it so difficult? Why is it, what do we need to do? What does the University of Minnesota need to do, to be more responsive?
Okay, so the question is, why is it so difficult for medical professions from the United States to come and work in a place like Darfur? Well, amongst the most important reasons for me is that when you ended up your medical school, you're going to be minus $230,000. Congratulations on that. Then you find a nice girl who wants to marry you, and that'll set you back a little bit as well, and also set you forward, obviously. Then you'll have children that want to go to Harvard and Yale, and you need to pay for that. And then you buy a subprime mortgage, and you're going to go another $600,000 down. So you're financially bound. The system in the United States is such that you are suckered into staying into this country, whatever you do, however good your intentions are. Now, most of the non-governmental organizations want people to come for 6, 9 to 12 months. I am an exception. I came from Holland, where we have these socialistic crazy stuff going on. I ended up my med school, guess how much money I was in the minus? Zero. Well, I boozed a little bit, so I got minus 2,000. But that's my story. So I had an opportunity. Besides that, I chose not to become a specialist. Bear in mind, I only have a doctor's degree and a master's degree and a diploma. And I invested in myself to go to London, which is the best or one of the best schools in the world in tropical medicine. So you have a lot of factors going against you. Now, that does not mean that you cannot come to Africa. In fact, you're welcome to join my organization, which is up here, which is going to cater to... that was a sad thing to do. Which is going to cater to having medical professionals come over and get an opportunity to work. Let me just go down a little bit. It's called Phoenix Global Humanitarian Foundation. I think there's a place for everybody, first of all, to learn. And I think that it's not only about coming to Africa to help out, but how many homeless people do you have? You have 48 million people that are uninsured. My socialistic, silly country has zero. Okay, we have healthcare for all. Well, our healthcare system costs 7% of the GDP, and yours costs 12%. So let's talk reality here. There's a lot of things in the United States that are beautiful and remarkable and admirable, and some things are just not. And your healthcare system is set up in a way that it's just not positive. So if you want to expand as a medical student or as a future nurse or as a future, why don't you help out the homeless people in or the Somali population, 70,000 thereof in Minnesota? I'm sure that half of them don't have proper health care. I'm sure they have issues of diabetes mellitus, which you need to know a lot about when you're a medical doctor. I'm sure that they may have infectious diseases. I'm sure that they need basic care and tendering too. So there's a plethora of opportunity. If you now want to go beyond, contact me through Facebook. And by the way, do become my friend on Facebook. I have a race with myself to reach 5,000 by the end of this tour. I'm 2,300. I'm 2,700 short, so I'm optimistic. So, yes, I admire your spirit. I hope to see you in Uganda. You're welcome. See you there. That'll be my answer. Anybody else? Question is, what's the role of livestock in a refugee camp? Well, despite that they had only 5 gallons of water per person, we had an organization called ACTED, a French organization, that did a head count of chicken, goats, cows, camels. And guess what? There were 40,000 livestock in the camp. So despite that they don't have enough water to live and to drink off, apparently, we still have all those livestock living there. You talk about that's the way they survive, actually, because to enhance their diets, they need to enhance some meat to their diets, which is basically based on what you get from the United Nations. Nowadays, 1,100 kilocalories, which is half the requirements. So, yes, the fact that they have chicken make a big deal and a big difference for eggs and meat and everything else. I think we've truly gone through our time. 15 past. Again, thank you very much for having me.
You can leave your evaluation notes just on the back table as you leave. Thank you again so much for coming, and thank you so much, Ashish.
Did you like it?